The most beautiful woman in the world. Sorry, listeners, I just wanted to recreate the experience of the opening of this film.
Wait. Okay.
Oh, hi.
Hello,
frame
and welcome.
One.
Bonus episode, Kill James Bond. You know who we are, case you don't. It's Alice Caldwell-Kelly, joined by my friends, Devin and Abigail Thorne.
Hey.
What's up?
Said you in the wrong order. It feels viscerally wrong.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just got fucking upgraded.
I promoted you.
Yeah. Shit, I've been downgraded. Fuck.
Oh, you're the Devin now. Tragic.
I have to do so much behind the scenes work now.
Weirdly, me becoming the Abbey means I have to go to the gym more, which is...
Joined, as always, by my friends, Abigail Thorne and
yes,
Devin.
Back
yes,
on
you
top,
can
baby.
Consider that a system of rank.
Oh.
So it was my pick.
You got to keep the talent happy, you know.
It was my pick for the first bonus episode of the season of Solidarity. And I did something that I threatened to do for a long time, which is to make you all watch a Paolo Sorrentino movie. In this case, 2005's The Consequences of Love, La Consequenza dell'Amore. A movie about lonely Italian men.
Yes, primarily.
Lonely Italian men in your area just want heroin.
My wife is not talking to me. I don't want to remarry. I only want heroin.
You know, I was trying to save up the fact that I had the...
In the butt.
Not the drop I wanted. I was trying to.
That's a drawback. Well, that's good.
Yeah, I was trying to save up the fact that I had
heroin
saved up, but you know, whatever.
So, I think someone else who's got heroin saved up. It's the guy from
guy.
The movie.
The guy from the movie, The Consequences of Love. So, this movie, I kind of struggle to introduce it a little bit because. There's some mystery to it. It's quite slow in terms of what it reveals to you. And we've sort of done most of it in the first 3 minutes, 35 seconds. But so it begins with a sort of like...
Sorry, it begins with a shot of the most beautiful woman in the world.
Yes, the most beautiful woman in the world. Also a guy taking a weirdly, really long travelator.
Yes.
Like, those horizontal escalators.
Yeah.
With a big suitcase.
Real... Like, you're watching a film ass opening shot. Like,
yeah,
it takes him, like, 5 minutes fully, and it's uninterrupted of him going forward. I was like, when I was trying to get home from Chicago, this is basically what it felt like.
See, every shot of a film is a you're watching a film ass shot, but also I understand exactly what you mean when you say that. It's very much like cinema.
Yes, there's some like, pretensions here, but it earns them, I think. Especially like being jolted out of that shot by him reaching the end of this travelator. If you didn't know that's what those horizontal escalators are called, now you do. And like pulling the suitcase over the grate and it making the really like dissonant like noise. And then we meet lonely Italian man in your area.
As long as your area is Switzerland.
Yes, Ticino specifically, in the southern Italian-speaking bit of Switzerland, where we will spend the rest of this movie.
Lonely dilfs just want heroin.
His wants are more complex than just heroin.
Yes, that's true. He also wants the most beautiful woman in the world.
Well, this is the thing. Ostensibly, he has no wants to start with. He is this sort of like older Italian man, very like well-dressed, lots of like suits and turtlenecks, absolutely serious and sort of pointedly ignoring the most beautiful woman in the world, who is, you know, the waitress in, as we later find out, like the cafe of the hotel where he lives.
But he's doing that meme with the guy standing in the corner of the party, people dancing, being like, no one here knows I'm a very serious older Italian man.
Yes.
And they're all going, we all know you're a very serious older Italian man. Because he's watching this young man who's like hitting on two women and also the bartender. And he's like, gives this monologue in voiceover about like, oh, it's so, life is so boring. And like, it's so boring when dudes hit on girls. Why do Stacey's always go out with Chads?
See, there's more nuance to it than that, because what he says is, and this is his opening line, by the way, the worst thing for a man who spends a lot of time alone is lack of imagination. And so he looks at this guy with the women with him and the most beautiful woman in the world, who is kind of like flirting with him. She's like bending over the table so he can see down her top. And he's like, you know, normal people would speculate about what this guy does, what his deal is, would like imagine a whole like inner life for him. I don't do that because I only see someone who is frivolous. I am not frivolous. There is only one thing that is frivolous about me, and it is my stupid-ass Italian name, which is Tita Di Girolamo.
That is a very frivolous Italian name.
It's a funny bit that this guy's name is Tita, which is kind of, like, ridiculous.
Is it? I don't really have a barometer for Italian names.
Just sounds a bit silly and a bit juvenile, and he's, like, this, you know, two things that he's not at all.
Is it like the Italian equivalent of Jimmy?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Slipping Jimmy.
Any Jimmy's listening.
But so he makes contact with this waitress finally, and then realizes that she's not looking at him, but looking past him at a funeral cortege that's going past, like on horseback. You get some really interesting, like, some sound work where you hear the sort of like clatter of the hoofs of the like horse-drawn hearse outside, and then sort of very muffled inside, and you know, this feeling of like separation through this plate glass wall.
Yeah, because this film does something really interesting with the themes of like, in particular, aging masculinity, which is something we haven't seen a whole lot of on the podcast so far. But like, he's really staring down the barrel, is Tita, and like we see later on, there's an older couple in the hotel too that he's kind of a little bit obsessed with.
Yeah, but from moment one, he's always associated with, always close to death, right? And, you know, when she looks past him at, you know, like a dead body, that's an example of what we in the trade like to call foreshadowing.
My God.
Yeah.
Cinema.
Crazy, right? This movie has themes. And you know, I'm not being sort of down on it in that way. I think, you know, like we said about, you know, the fact that it's cinema with the capital C, it kind of earns that. But there are a few times when you go, oh, I'm hitting the big themes button.
And he's basically just a Sigma male, because people in this hotel are constantly trying to talk to him.
We'll get to this bit. Okay.
Well, so Sophia says goodbye as she's leaving, and he just ignores her. Another guy comes and is like, oh, hey, I'm like here on a business trip. I'm alone. Like, do you want a game of chess? And he's just like, nah, whatever. Like, just giving him like one word answers. Yeah.
He lies about what company he works for. He says he works for an investment firm, and he gives the name of like a company he's read on, the name of a blender or something. So I want to talk about the Sigma maleness of this, because the whole first sequence of this movie, right, he absolutely goes out of his way not to speak to women. The most beautiful woman in the world routinely tries to like attract his attention, even to provoke him. At one point, she like I think deliberately leaves a curtain open so he can see her like get changed and take her shirt off. You know, later on, she'll actually confront him about this. The maid who cleans his room is kind of like obsessively curious. He doesn't say a word to her, to the point of rudeness. He'll just leave a conversation and just walk away from them. And so, you can make this joke, right, that this is a Sigma male, right? Like, like from the memes, you know, I speak, you know, English to my friends, Arabic to God, and I don't speak to women, right?
100%. I'm already imagining it. I'm like, it's in black and white. It's cutting back and forth from him. Can you break broken heart?
He's a Chad and so on.
Yes.
I have laid a trap here, because as soon as you said Sigma male, you have activated the sort of secret trap phrase here, because I have some thoughts.
It's been a while since I've played Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yeah. So I think the fact that we can make this joke, and the fact that we know listeners will get it and will laugh, speaks to how normalized a really extreme form of misogyny has become since 2005, when this movie was made. Because this is not a subtle movie about like spiritual poverty and like internal exile, and this is not by any accounts a man who is doing well in any sphere of his life, but like we have this framework existing already in memes or whatever to valorize this guy even ironically. And I think that's really revealing and really sad.
That's a fair point, actually. I mean, I guess when we are making fun of the idea of a Sigma male being something to aspire to, but there are people who genuinely think that, like, yes, if a woman talks to you, you should simply turn around and walk away.
Yeah, and because like, we're making fun of it, yes, but we're doing that, like, in language that has been set out by people who actually believe that. The existence of the, like, Sigma male as a figure is, like, a manifestation of that kind of, like, incel thought projected, like, much, much larger than their actual influence is. And I think I'm going to come back to inceldom on this one, about this guy specifically, about Tito Di Girolamo. But so we see his life in this hotel, which is absolutely monotonous. He lives like a monk, right? His room is completely empty. He doesn't speak to women. I like the scene where the maid is like looking around his hotel room trying to figure out like, what the fuck is this guy's deal? It's like so visibly curious, and he's just like, you know, absolutely uninterested, uninteresting. There is nothing there. There is no
depth. Yeah, there's like no hint of personality even in like the decor. He's got no little tchotchkes. It's just a hotel room. It may as well have he might as well have just moved into it like a day ago.
The picture is like really desaturated too. It's really, you know, leaning on the sterileness of it, sterility, I suppose. So we also see that the closest things he has to friends, I guess, are these two older people, Carlo and Isabella. And they're a married couple. Carlo is a little bit older than Isabel. And they're introduced having dinner, the three of them. And Carlo is saying, I'm a selfish old man and I ruined your life. They're like having this weird argument, which we sense they've had a lot, where it's like, oh no, like we've fallen on hard times. We hear that they used to own the hotel, they used to be very wealthy, and now they don't, now they just live in a hotel room. Tito is so disgusted by this that he just like stops eating and just smokes a cigarette at the window, which he usually does. That's just his answer to everything, is he simply leaves.
Yeah, he ends the conversation. We do get one sort of weirdly mismatched comedy moment that I don't care for in this sequence, which is he's looking out of the window at one point and he sees the most beautiful woman in the world leave work after doing this. Another interesting piece of like sound design and acting, after she like leaves and says, pointedly says like bye to him and he ignores her, she like very aggressively zips her coat up. Like a sort of big zip noise, and then leaves. But he's watching her go out the window, and a guy can't stop looking at her and like walks into a lamppost with a really like comedic bonk sound effect. And it just, the kind of like just rips me out of the movie for a second. Like,
I don't know, I appreciated it a little. It's just like a little a moment.
I think you have to play it like darker than that. I don't know. It would have been fine but for the sound effect, in the same way as the fucking like corkscrew jump thing in Man with the Golden Gun, you know?
That's fair.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair.
We also see that he keeps losing at cards to Carlo.
This couple have fucked patter. Absolutely atrocious Grabber. Vibes in this room.
The name of the card game is Grabber. It's like a kind of a childish game. And it's a game that he knows from his childhood in Salerno. He's Sicilian, we find out. And this couple are sort of like arguing, and he's losing to them. And you can kind of like, even reading between the lines on this scene, kind of tell that he's like losing on purpose. And Carlo, the husband, he has this sort of thing where he says, across these two scenes, across like dinner and then this card game, that he is sort of like, he's scared of dying of old age, right? Not because he doesn't want to die, but because he doesn't want to die in a way that's sort of like mundane. He wants to die extraordinarily. And the one thing that sort of like seems to animate Tito here is he says, well, it takes courage to die an extraordinary death, which at first seems like a kind of like armchair thing, but again is, you know, what we in the trade call foreshadowing, right?
Yeah. We also see that he is an insomniac, and when he can't sleep at night, he uses a stethoscope to eavesdrop on Carlo and Isabel's conversations in their room.
And they're just listing things that they used to own. Like, it's like a really weird, stilted conversation. They're just naming antique things that they used to control.
He has lost it all gambling. I think it is important that the husband lost all of their money by gambling too, because that's also themes. And he's like, oh, I'm gonna win it all back one day. You know, I'm gonna take the last thing that you own from your inherited wealth, which is the portrait of like one of your bullshit ancestors, sell it and go to Monte Carlo. And Tito sort of like listens to this, seemingly unresponsive but thoughtful. Because as we say, he can't sleep. And it has an interesting little meditation on insomnia where it's like, you know, people say to insomniacs, but you know, if you're not sleeping, you could like read or you could watch TV or whatever. And it's like, no, when you're an insomniac, your only craving, your obsession is sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Which I liked. I thought it was perceptive. Essentially, we have this routine now, and I think the first, you know, half hour of the movie does a great job of setting up this mm-hmm. routine, right? Where he's been doing this for years.
Eight years, we find out.
Mm-hmm. And he has a routine, a part of which is
heroin.
And another interesting take, I think, which is it has a kind of strange nuance about heroin and about drugs, where it's like he doesn't consider himself a drug addict because he has a rule. And the mm-hmm. rule is that he only does heroin at like a specific time on a specific day, like once a week. He never even speaks to the dealer. He like spoke to him on the phone once years ago to set the whole thing up. And then once a year, he has like a full like dialysis just to like make sure he's still healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He takes heroin 10 o'clock Wednesday morning every week for the last 24 years.
Mm-hmm. Wednesday yeah. morning, he's prepping for the full day of heroin.
Also, yeah, I want to say props to that dealer for staying in the business for 24 years. As I understand it, it's not a career that you like usually do that like has a lot of longevity or like
it's not a steady.
No.
I watch some shows about this.
Another sort of mismatched names joke here where his dealer's name is Ludovico and he's like, that's a pretty like serious name for a drug dealer. We should like switch, you know?
Mm. He gets high as balls and walks around a shopping center.
Yeah, because it's the only way of like enhancing this experience of just walking around this fucking mall in Ticino. And the way that they do this is quite nice. So they just add like sort of pulsing like club lighting into this regular mall scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
We've established his routine, and now the whole rest of the movie is about going to be like, well, how does that routine get broken, right? And the first thing that breaks it is he comes back to the cafe where the most beautiful woman in the world works, and he finds two young women sitting at his usual table, and he doesn't sort of quite know what to do with this. He just kind of like passive-aggressive bullies them out of his seat, mm-hmm. but only into the next seat so he can sit where he's used to.
And then they're talking about like, I think they're talking about theater or art or something. They're young and they have like passion and excitement. And she's
reading from Celine's Journey to the End of the Night.
Oh.
Louis Ferdinand Celine, sort of pre-fascist writer. And the central theme of the bit that she's reading is that sort of life, exhilaration in a kind of like fascist futurist way, admittedly, but like real life and real danger is the shit, right? And drugs are boring because they take you away from that. The line is that like cocaine is a mere station master's pastime. You know, it's something you do to break up the days, which is exactly how he uses heroin.
And so he leaves, as he always does when a woman says anything. He just gets up and goes.
I've written average Italian conversation a couple of times in a row here because he has a chat with a dude in the bank as well.
Yeah, this is actually it's the hotel manager. He's paying for his
His room.
His room, like by the month or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he's had, you know, 8 times 12. Yeah, fucking.
People used to just like retire and start living in a hotel. Do they do that anymore? Is that still?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to have insane money, like Thatcher did. Thatcher retired to the Ritz and then died horribly. Ha. I don't know if you can do it unless you're like mad wealthy.
Fuck.
Mm.
Oh well.
Yeah. But so he has this conversation with the manager who's like, hey, that guy you lied to about what you do for work earlier asked me. And I, being a sort of perfect paragon of Swiss discretion, told him, like, we don't just divulge any information on our clients. You feel like divulging any information, though, right now? Because I'm really curious.
He's like, what do you do, bro? And this guy, he fucking exhales his cigarette. He is, of course, smoking.
Of course.
And he goes, tell me the deepest, darkest secret in your life, and I'll tell you mine. And you know mm-hmm. what? And they do it. because this is how Italian people speak to each other when they reach 60.
And yet, I really like this conversation because
me too.
The manager considers this, like, tell me your deepest, darkest secret. And then he says something which quite clearly isn't that. He says, well,
yeah.
One time I stole a pair of skis from someone. and kind of like, hey, ho, whatever. And in exchange, Tita tells him, oh, when I was a kid, I ate my baby brother's food once. So like Tita surmises that this is not really your deepest, darkest secret, and therefore I'm not really going to tell you mine. I'm going to tell you something that's similarly unserious. So he's just like, I ate my baby brother's food once, and then gets up and leaves.
Yeah,
he's always doing this.
He doesn't know how to he just leaves. He exfiltrates. He gets out of there.
That's right.
The moment he's done chatting, he is done, and I respect that.
But so the hearing the like Celine quote has kind of like opened his soul a little bit.
Yeah.
And you kind of get the sense the next time he's in the cafe that like he is thinking about this.
Because he calls his wife.
Yeah. He looks at the most beautiful woman in the world in a completely different way, where he actually looks at her. And then he calls his wife and his kids. And his wife and kids are like completely icy towards him.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-wife, I should say. They've been separated. And she has nothing to say to him. He doesn't know what to say to her other than like, how's it going? Fine. Can you put the kids on? Okay.
We even see one of them just like shakes his head. Just like, no.
Yeah. His sons don't want to speak to him. It's his daughter who speaks to him. And she's kind of like, I like this. She's as sarcastic as he sometimes is towards him. And it just, he gets the phone back to his ex-wife and he's just like, oh, she's gotten witty. And it just, again, makes no impression whatsoever. He's just completely frozen out. And so no connections there, none. Still can't sleep. Listens in on the old couple again, where again, Carlo is like, my life used to be spectacular, you know? And his wife's like, well, the spectacle's over. It's just sad.
Like, bro, man, you're in a toxic environment. You've got to get out of there, dude. The vibes are atrocious in this hotel.
Yeah. It was purgatorial, and it's meant to feel that way, you know?
And then shit happens.
Then, yes, then we have to throw another wrench into the works.
2000s editing.
Beats, baby.
Yeah, yeah, I have some thoughts about this.
We've seen the Matrix.
So a woman in sunglasses, a pretty anonymous woman, leaves a case, a big suitcase in his room. And this case gets like several back and forth shots. The way that he looks at it is, I think, really beautifully acted. He has this like absolute foreboding. But he gets changed, doesn't open the case, just like he gets changed, gets a gun, which we see like a couple of really short shots of as he like gets it out and like he throws his jacket over it and you'd almost forget it was there. And then he goes and he takes this case and his gun, and he goes and like takes the like cover off of a BMW that's parked in the garage of the hotel. But the whole time, as he delivers this case to a Swiss bank,
it sounds like a Citroen ad, man. It's crazy. It's so good. Early 2000s time capsule hits this movie like a truck.
I know.
Sick.
I think the nostalgia thing has swung around to early 2000s, though. I'm like wary of it.
It's just cool to see this kind of, I'm just like, oh, wow, that's a real throwback. Like, I didn't realize that we weren't doing this anymore, but
yeah,
it's fun to see.
To the early 2000s in the news just the other day, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I
get the point of doing it, though. I mean, because it's trying to make the point that it's the only interesting or, like, cool thing that he does, and that's why he gets the cool music, is he, like, he kind of changes persona, too. He, like, seems to, like, get taller. He's, like, you know, he's in a much sharper suit than usual. He's driving the BMW. When he gets to the bank, they open the door for him. And a guy, like, carries the case that's, you know, down the sort of travelator to the vault, which is where the thing was in the opening shot. But, like, man, the music fucking sucks. But we see him in this sort of, like, new powerful attitude in the room with the manager and a bunch of tellers as they count by hand the contents of this suitcase, which is, of course, a shitload of US dollars.
Yeah.
In hundreds.
Millions.
Yes. And the bank manager, again, because everybody's asking about this guy, if you just don't tell anyone about your shit, apparently people will be intrigued enough to sort of ask you very prying questions, to the point that a Swiss bank manager is like, hey, do you want to tell me some stuff about the thing? Because he asks him, like, why do you insist on having us count this by hand instead of like using the machine? And he doesn't even look away from the window he's looking at. He just says, oh, we must never lose faith in our fellow man.
Yeah, it's hard. This is the one cool thing he does. And he's really good at it.
Well, we find out why he insists on it later. But yeah, he shifts into cool mode.
Yes, this is his cool mode. And it lasts as long as it takes him to take the case to the BMW, drive the BMW to the bank, watch them count the money, have them take the money to the vault, and then leave.
I mean, does he get a little coffee on the way back? Does he, like, does he get a girl treat on bank days?
He should. He gets a little pumpkin spice latte. It's like canonically fall, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He holds it with both hands and, like, exhales on it, like, ah.
Yeah.
Takes a picture for his Instagram, which hasn't been invented.
Mm-hmm.
And, and that night, as he's lying in bed, we get this incredible bit where, like, so he's thinking about all the women he's seen. He thinks about the woman in sunglasses. He thinks about Sophia, the most beautiful woman in the world, and his wife and stuff, and his marriage. But he just has this, like, look on his face of just absolute, like, boredom and disgust. And my notes say, thinking about women. I posted this on the Kill James Bond Twitter account. That's the face he's making when he thinks about women.
My joke was, like, because, like, I think that he is masturbating in this scene, though. He's just doing it totally, like, impassively, thinking about, like, every woman he's seen that week, right?
Jacking off of the mind?
Yeah. I think you can see his hand moving under the covers. Before this scene, he does go back to the cafe. This is where she, like, takes her shirt off and I think, like, deliberately lets him see her shirtless, so that in an attempt to really, like, provoke a reaction from him. Because he, like, hasn't at all. And the whole time he's in this cafe, by the way, we've been seeing him be, like, doodling on a little pad. And we actually see what he's writing for the first time. And this is, you know how sometimes movies will drop the title of the movie in a sort of really forced way?
Yeah, this is a fucking clanger.
I don't think so. This is the only time I like it, to be honest.
I kind of like this.
Because I think it's entirely, like, Jermaine, but, like, what he's writing down is he's writing his, like, to-do list, and the thing that he writes is non sotto valutare le conseguenze dell'amore, to not underestimate the consequences of love, right? Which I like. You know, he's having to, like, fucking reinforce the, like, walls of his own mental prison here. He's like, don't fucking do it. Do the thing. Do not, under any circumstances, open your soul in any way.
I'm always putting that on my to-do list. I'm looking at my to-do list here. Write that talk I have to do. Email this person. Prepare for this role. The last item on my to-do list is always believe in the future. So I guess I do kind of have this.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Get a bra fitting.
And then, as often happens, sort of a Scrooge-like thing, your young nephew or whatever rocks up.
It's his brother, the same one he, like, ate his food, yeah. His stupid 20 years younger stepbrother, who is going to be a surfing instructor in the Maldives.
Hell
and
yeah.
And is stopping off on his way. He has the Chad hair and the Chad jaw.
What do you mind if secondary did this?
He looks like the Chad. Like, it's remarkable.
Consequences of being a legend.
He rocks up and he's like, what about if you opened your heart to love, huh? And he's like, oh, fuck, all right. All right.
He's not even like that, because he's like, he's harder than that. He says, you're not a serious man. You're not even a man. You're like a large boy. And he kind of is. He reads him correctly. His brother is like a sort of, like, overgrown teenager. But he is capable of, like, feeling emotions.
I gotta say, this is the kind of movie that, had I watched it at the age of about 14, would have fucked me up for years. I would have been wearing, like, turtlenecks and suit jackets even more than I already was, because, like, I was also very possessed of this idea that in order to be male, you have to be serious and not feel anything. And it's just like, that shit kills you.
Secret Alice lore unlocked. Would you like to know when I first saw this movie?
Did you buy a lot of turtlenecks after?
I didn't copy the fashion sense, but I did similarly conceive of the idea that masculinity should be a sort of unemotional, walled, monastic cell.
The monastic cell,
Another little thing lights up on the switchboard. I understand Alice a little better again.
Right. I also did this.
What a
privilege. I wore some very sharp suits and very stern expressions for a long time. A lot of heroin!
See, I never did the heroin thing. It was mainly being sad.
Well, I had a schedule for it.
Ah, fair enough.
but so his stepbrother tries to, like, force the issue. He notices this waitress and he's like, damn, that's the most beautiful woman in the world. And she really is. And he goes, you know, you should, like, ask her out or something. And if you don't, I will. And, of course, Tita doesn't, so his brother does.
And she shoots his brother down, kind of. And then as she's leaving, she says goodbye to Tita and he ignores her again. And she calls him out. She goes out and is just like, I've worked here for 2 years. I say goodbye to you every day. Are you ever going to notice me? And Tita just like gets up and walks out. Just to complete Sigma male shit. Just like, nope.
Not interested. But this is the thing. Like, it really is like Chad and incel here. Like, billions must be deposited. Because he's just like... it's like, bro, you have to like open your heart to love. There is also one other bit in the scene before she leaves, where he mentions, his brother mentions like offhandedly, hey, you remember Dino Giuffre? Well, I was talking to his brother and he's like working as like an electrician or some shit. And Tito really responds to this and goes, of course I remember Dino Giuffre. He's my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, oh, okay. Well, when did you speak to him last? And it's like, oh, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can he be your best friend if you haven't spoken in 20 years? And Tita is just like, absolutely sort of like straight, literal-minded. No, if he said we were best friends forever, he is still my best friend. Like,
for real, though. This is male friendships.
I didn't quite understand what this was about, but...
Well, first of all, it's really fucking sad, right?
Yeah.
That he, like, this is his closest friend. This is his best friend. And it's, you know, something that he's still holding on to. It's something that he still values, even though it's completely sort of, like, well, I don't want to say it's meaningless, because the movie's sort of, in large part, about whether or not it's meaningless. But, like, it doesn't sort of, it's not material. Like, his brother compares him to an imaginary friend, right? And he says, no, it's not like that. This is a real guy who is my best friend. We just don't speak, right?
To be fair, I remember my best friend from junior school, from, like, age 3 until age 11, when he moved away to Japan, and we never spoke again. I still remember him with some degree of fondness.
Yeah, and if you were sort of, like...
Should look him up, actually.
Hidebound and this sort of like stuck in masculinity and this unwilling to ever make any other connections with anyone ever, it might well feel to you that like, yeah, that's still my best friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Sam if you're listening. How's it going, buddy? turns out I'm a woman, which whoa, might explain some shit.
Shout out to Alfred, who I know is listening. How you doing, bud?
Your butler?
So
I'll message back at some point, pal. Yeah, my butler. But the thing that this guy does as well, because it's sort of like a totem for loneliness, right? The thing that this guy does is that he's an electrician in the Alps. He's like, yes, on his own, the biting cold, just like repairing fucking like power lines.
Yeah, when the thing breaks, he has to climb up there and fix it. And as the brother says, it's a shit life.
Yes. And as the guy's like, yeah, but it's a life.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of like, he implies that he values that kind of life just as equally as he would value being, you know, a fucking surf instructor in the Maldives.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
It's nice.
So his brother leaves. Mm-hmm. And we see that later that evening, he has a date with the most beautiful woman in the world, which he fucks up. He strikes out with her because he like tries to like grope her chest. Like, like he comes on way too strong and she like kind of like laughs it off and pushes him away. And she's like, okay, well, bye.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, an interesting little moment. Tita is, of course, you know, in his room, completely sort of like inert. And then ultimately, all of these things together conspire to the point that he is able the next day to come down to the cafe and come and sit at the bar instead of his usual sort of like corner and look her in the eyes.
He
says, sitting at this bar is the most dangerous thing I've done in my life. And she smiles like that's a line, but of course we know that like he's telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. Heroin is pretty dangerous.
Yeah, but like it's not just physical danger, it's like emotional danger, you know? It's the thing that Carlo was talking about dying extraordinarily, right? And the sort of the courage required to do that.
Yeah.
And, like, he knows that this is going to, like, perhaps fatally compromise his routine. And his routine is the thing that has been keeping him alive for the last 8 years. But
we see that it makes him smile, though. As he's walking back to his room, he smiles to himself. And it's a testament to how good this performance is, because, like, when I saw him doing this, I was like, what's that actor doing weird with his face? And I was like, oh, he's smiling. It's just we hadn't seen him do that for the first, like, 40 minutes of the movie.
The Lion Awakens, boys. He's a sensitive Italian sexual dynamo now. He's fucking ready. Yeah. He's opened his heart up to the universe, and as so often happens, it deposits two mafia guys straight into his hotel room.
Yeah. Two... I mean, listen, right? I don't want to sort of stereotype.
I have a lot to say.
However, all I'm saying is... these two motherfuckers show up, and if I had to describe them, right? Oh, I mean,
there's a big guy and a thin guy.
Mm-hmm.
No, fuck, hold on, they're
criminals.
We'll cut that down, and they're criminals, right? Like, and the thing is, they're like your unglamorous organized crime. Like, one of them's in his fucking bathtub eating a Mars bar, the other one's cleaning his Beretta at his table, and when he gets in the door, he's like, are you for me? Like, are you here to kill me?
Like, yeah, there's this really funny line where he's like, Tita's like shitting himself, like, are you here to kill me? Yeah. And the big guy lets him sweat for a bit as he's cleaning the gun, and he's like, come in, close the door, and he's like, maybe I did something wrong, I'm really sorry, like, tell me what it is and I'll fix it. And then the big guy has this line where he says, don't flatter yourself, if we were here to kill you, you'd be dead.
So good.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And as he says, you know, it's not a quiz show. You've already asked me four questions. And, you know, in our business, it's one is too many. Just fucking do your job. We need the hotel room for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy, the younger guy, gets out of the bathtub and puts on the most hideous crisp packet texture tracksuit you've ever seen in your life.
Oh, my God. This is crazy. The shell suit goes insane. This is it's the most powerful assassination fit I've ever seen.
This man looks like GTA 4 custom outfit. Like, he looks great.
It's like the Italian version of urban camo. Like, nobody sees this boy moving through the environment.
They hear him, though. They hear him, like, and hear him going, ow, every time he touches a metal railing and gets a static shock.
The closest analog to this I can think of is whenever we do talk about layer cake, which I think is going to be in robbery season.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of thing of, like,
we get down on.
Clumsy, tacky, like, the sort of, the crime equivalent, the organized crime equivalent of the figure of the chav, right, is these guys.
Yeah.
And... It's like, it's intended to be such a contrast to Tito and his, like, turtleneck bullshit that it's no. At the end of it, the thing that, like, gets all the money in that suitcase is, you know, guys in shell suits shooting people. As they go out to do. The guy puts on the shell suit, he puts on a pair of glasses. With both of those, he looks quite a lot like Pietro Alighieri in his prime. I'm not sure if that's an intentional reference or not. But yeah, he just goes and he, like, kills a guy, and his son, who uses a wheelchair, sees it and he kills him too. It's sort of like blasé, you know?
The blasé-ness is highlighted because this guy's smoking throughout, and when he goes to do the kill, he puts the fucking cigarette down so that the, like, ash is overhanging, so it doesn't go out, and he can just keep smoking it afterwards. Like, this is so run-of-the-mill to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a really funny line, actually, which is that he gets back and the older guy says, "What are any complications?" And he says, "Well, I got hungry at one point."
It's
like,
jeez,
fucking hell, dude. So yeah, they do this job.
Tita is visibly disturbed by this.
Yes,
and as they are preparing to go, there's another knock at the door, and another suitcase has been delivered. And as the big guy and the little guy are on the way out, the big guy says, oh, hey, you know, that's where all our hard work ends up in that case.
Crazy.
So we see them notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also, as well, just driving home that, like, hey, just so you know, you're carrying the bag for all of these, like, killings, you know?
Yeah.
And...
yeah, like, hey, you ever heard of a sin eater?
Yeah.
You motherfucker.
He tries to connect with the most beautiful woman in the world, and... what I've written down for this whole sequence is it is so difficult watching him try to be happy.
Mm.
Like, he like buys her this pair of shoes And he like walks around with her, and it's like, you know, she takes his arm and stuff. And I think he genuinely is happy. She's like a bit more of a sort of a cipher about it, but it's like, meanwhile, everything else in the movie is sort of like blaring alarms at you, you know, like this cannot last. Mm-hmm. This is the reason why you've sort of like been isolating yourself for the last 8 years, is because this is impossible and incredibly dangerous.
He also he bluffs the bank, because he does another run to the bank with this case full of money, they count up the money and they say, so there's $100,000 missing. And he tells them, put all the money back in the case immediately and close my account. I'm never doing business with you again. And they're just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, let's count it again, big
maybe you want us to use the machine. And he's like, he absolutely, like he says in sort of a voiceover that like, there's no half bluffs, right? You have to follow it through absolutely and completely. So
his voiceover is like, go sicko mode. Do not go sicko mode. Be afraid of seeming like a moron.
take no off ramps offered you. And when they're like, well, maybe we could like compensate you for the missing $100,000, that he's like, this is an insult. You know, I could not be more insulted. You're asking me to accept your charity.
He said, I'd be less offended if you killed my mother.
And so finally, there's a beautiful sort of like depiction of how institutions tend to handle things like this, which is one of the tellers just sort of on her own knocks four bundles of the thing off the table and then picks them back up. It's just like, oh, hey, I found these. Sorry, we completely miscounted. You don't have to like take your business elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And he just like brazens it out.
Bank basically just give him $100,000.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Which we see he spends in part on his dialysis for his heroin. Mm-hmm. We see him in the big reclining chair getting all his blood sucked
out. Dude starts talking to a woman one time and immediately steals $100,000 of mafia money. Mm-hmm.
And replaces all of his blood.
Well, he needs to look young. I don't know, man. Like,
I have done this.
That's why his
you
sons don't
me.
Want to talk to him anymore, because he tried all that fucking blood shit with him.
You guys know me. I've done this four times this year alone.
Abigail is actually in her like late 70s. She's just...
I'm always talking to women and stealing $100,000 and replacing my blood. Not even just women either. Yeah.
He goes to this card game as usual, and then as he's sort of like about to, as he would normally leave, he walks over to Carlo, reaches in his pocket and pulls out the like fistful of aces he has hidden there. And when Carlo's like, well, what does this mean? What are you doing? He says, it means I've stopped losing. Again, extremely hardcore shit.
Yeah.
Right.
Sicko
mode.
And
he buys Sophia a car with $100,000.
Interesting shot where they're both sort of like wrapped in the garage, and his car, the one that he uses to deliver the money, is like literally overshadowing hers. But she just gets her driver's license, we find out. This is a little bonding moment between them, as he asks her earlier about her boyfriends, and she's like, no, they're driving instructors. And he's like, oh, so that's why you always get in the driver's seat. And she sort of like realizes how closely he's been watching her and kind of likes it. But yeah, she just gets her license and he gives her like a BMW M3. And there's a beautiful, beautiful line in this sequence that I really, really want to highlight, which is she says, "Why? Well, I can't take this. I mean, to accept a gift like this would alter our relationship completely." And he just looks at her and he says, like, just this incredibly earnest, subdued way, "I want to alter our relationship completely." And it's just like, oh my god,
he doesn't
god,
get it,
dude.
Man. He's not.
Makes me want to fucking cry. And no, she doesn't take it, and he just like leaves her with the keys.
He activates his special move, which is that he just walks away from the conversation.
Just leaves. Yeah.
He hits the bricks.
Yes.
These bricks are dust from how often my man hits them.
so he goes up to his room and he does some heroin.
Unscheduled heroin.
He does it the one time he has ever deviated from his heroin procedure. And she comes up to his room because she wants to see how he lives. And as he says, he kind of like skewers her on this. He says, no, you felt needed, but I don't need anyone.
Because I have heroin.
And then he explains, you know, why he's like this and how he got this way. He explains his origin story to her, sparing us from the consequences of love origins, in which we would have found out that he used to be a stockbroker, he invested for the mafia, and much like Carlo, he gambled and lost. He lost 220 billion of their money.
Does the mafia have that much money? That seems like a lot.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I assume it's in lira at this point, yeah, but is. Like, yes, absolutely.
Really? That's like, that's an insane amount of money.
The mafia is just a large criminal organization. Anyway, yeah,
still?
So he
which is,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Very much.
Abby's I mean, if you're, damn, what the hell? I'm going to get into this shit.
Yeah, if you're in the mafia, write in.
Finding out about La Cosa Nostra. Yeah.
finding out about La Cosa Nostra. Holy shit, really?
Like, are you hiring?
So he lost
them. I can't
them.
Become a made man. I could become a different kind of maid.
220 billion lire. And so what they have done is they have deliberately and like punitively exiled him to Switzerland for the past 8 years, where they're like, no, your job now, presumably like on pain of death, is you live in this hotel, you deliver the bag to the thing once a month, and that's it. Like,
I'm sorry, but I feel like if I had 220 billion, I'd retire.
220 billion lira in 2005 money.
He says dollars.
Well, I mean, the mafia's into some shit, like mafia annual turnover. I assume they publish their accounts, right?
I just feel like if I had that much money, I'd stop being the mafia.
Yeah, Italy's organized crime networks take in around $14 billion a year. So even if they had, like, you know, 1% of that, that's still, you know, like $2 billion. So,
God, we gotta tax that.
Well, I mean, yeah, if only the Italian state, the Italian government was able to exercise control over some of the functions of organized crime. Crazy. Can you imagine? But yeah, so this is why he's here. And he says, you know, he explains about the heroin, he explains about his wife and kids, and he says, yeah, I've deviated from the heroin protocol one time tonight because
the heroin protocol is like one of the darkest Robert Ludlum novels.
but the reason why is not only because she has just sort of like rejected his BMW, but also because tomorrow is his 50th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
He is a little birthday boy in this moment.
Have a little heroin for your birthday.
Yeah, as a treat.
Get a really clean drop for that one. It's your birthday. Like, oh, what are you doing? Come on.
Have a girl treat, heroin.
Mm. But so he fully like bears his soul to her.
Yeah.
And she offers him the greatest of all treasures, that which is hope. And she's like, well,
okay.
Tomorrow afternoon, I'll pick you up. We'll go to the mountains. We'll celebrate your birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next morning, he gets up, slightly still, like, heroinized, and is immediately handed another case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Immediately. Opens the door, the case is there. It's like, for fuck's sake. Okay.
So as he's brushing his teeth, the big guy from earlier puts a gun to his head. He's back. And he says, don't look at me or I'll blow your face off. And then he says, give me your car keys and the code to the safe. I'm taking the money. Me and the small guy from earlier on, who smokes his cigarettes and looks sick as fuck in the shell suit, we're taking the money.
He's got the shell suit on, so you know he's in murder mode.
You call your boss and try and convince him that it wasn't you who stole it.
An insanely hard line,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it's so good.
Fuck.
So
happy birthday, motherfucker.
Yes, absolutely.
And he goes, oh, but I'm just a little birthday boy.
You wouldn't kill a birthday boy.
I'm still lightly heroinized.
Mm.
Yeah, but so he does in fact call his boss Pippo Danto, and is like, they took the fucking case, and the guy goes, well, they wouldn't take the case, they're my cousins, like come to Turin or come to Milan, explain yourself, right,
to the boss, to the big guy who in another film would be played by Robert De Niro, like come That's and explain right. yourself to the big guy now, or like we will fucking kill you
immediately. And he's like,
I'll see you in 2 days.
He's like, I have a date.
It's like, it's my birthday.
And the mafia guy's like, understandable, have a good date.
No, they don't. They say, we're gonna fucking kill you. And he hangs up the phone on them.
He uses a special move again on the phone.
You can leave at any point in a conversation. It's like what Todd Howard was happy about for Fallout 4.
You can just leave.
And then, are you ready to get your heart broken?
Because it's not good.
It's not good.
He has this meeting with her at 3, and then we see him in the cafe, and it is 3:30, and he is just sitting there. He's got like a half-drunk glass of orange juice. He's like, like the second it hits 3:30, he just like, again, hits the bricks, leaves.
Sophia's right? Not there.
No,
because
he gave a very fast car to a young girl who just got her driver's license. And so she has been driving to meet him and was distracted by the combination of the radio, the phone, and like some agricultural sprinklers by the side of the road, crashes the car off the thing, unconscious. We know not whether dead or alive.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, the crash isn't filmed particularly well, I'm guessing for budget reasons. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely clear what's happened. It's almost like an old-fashioned Man from U.N.C.L.E. thing where we just get a sound effect and we cut to a stationary car. It's like, okay, that could have been done better. Whatever, we'll let it off.
We don't know whether or not she's dead. We, in fact, will not find out for the rest of the movie. I tend to think that she is, but that's just, you know.
It's just on the side of what's sadder, really.
Yes. Isabel from earlier comes to him and gives him a pile of money and says, this should pay for like what Carlo has taken from you at cards by cheating. Mm-hmm. By the way, you could have just said that you knew. You didn't have to humiliate my husband publicly. You are an evil man. Fuck you.
Yeah, and we also find out that she says, I sold something for it. And what we know from that, from his eavesdropping, is that she has sold the like last remnant of her like inherited wealth. She has sold this like painting, right? Which is like meaningful emotionally. And he takes this money from her and he doesn't sort of like respond. But he calls back Milan and he's like, well, okay, fuck it. I came to my senses a bit. I will meet you.
I struck like, out on my thing. Date. I'll be on the next plane. And they're like, oh, yeah, I'll be on the King.
They're like, oh, sorry, dude.
Another really heartbreaking line where the guy on the phone is like, well, how will I recognize you? It's been like 8 years. And he says, I haven't changed. And it's like,
oh.
But then, and there's a punchline to this, which just gets off the plane. And the guy doesn't recognize him. He has to go up and like introduce himself because he has fucking changed. Opening your heart to love changes you as a person.
So does heroin.
Well, I mean, not for him. Heroin is a way of keeping himself in stasis, really.
Yeah, he mostly opened his heart to love. That was the main thing, I think.
So
the FFS looks great. I didn't recognize you at all.
So from this moment, he is now surrounded by big guys. He is like functionally under arrest, right?
The thing about being in the mafia is you have to be huge, which is probably why I'm not going to get a job there.
Guys wearing like suits, full suits with t-shirts and a lot of like chest hair poke over the top.
Sadly, those days are over.
They drive him to the airport hotel next door, which is really funny as a secondary location. It's called the Hotel New Europe, which in itself feels like a bit of a joke. It's
very funny.
You see that Tita laughs and they're like, what the fuck are you laughing at? You might be about to die. And he's like, I'm sorry, I spend a lot of time in hotels.
Yeah, he's like, I can't escape hotels.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. That's such a cheap and convenient filming location.
They get him down to a conference room, and the way they get him there, they get a like. There's a close-in shot on his face in the lift, and then there's a like a first-person like point of view shot as he's walking. The whole thing, exquisite,
really
like
good.
Genuinely. The shot on his face, fantastic. You can see this motherfucker's pause, right? And as much as he like has determined to do something like stupid and courageous, as much as he is like kind of chosen voluntarily to like have the courage to die in an extraordinary way, he's still fucking shitting it.
Yeah. When he's like, explaining really, to the boss what happened, he can't even look him in the eye.
Yeah, it gives The Long Good Friday a run for its money, this one shot, I think. But so they get to the conference room. The conference room is set up like a courtroom, even.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the fact that it's like they've just clearly just hijacked the booking for another thing. It's for a conference on like experts in prostate diseases, which is
really I didn't spot that.
Yeah, which is both sort of like an immature joke, but also I think a bit sly because, you know, diseases of old men, organized crime and prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he gets sat down in front of this tribunal, in front of this guy who is like absolutely calm. And he says, right, well, tell me what happened.
He tells him they stole the bag, and then he reveals, but I got it back.
Yeah, I got it back. And he's like, well, what's the problem then? You could have just deposited it. It would have been like a, you know, it's a hiccup or whatever. And he's like, I don't want to give you the bag.
Well, we see in the flashback that...
No, not yet, no. we see like bits and pieces of it spread out after this, I think. But like all he says at this point is, I don't want to give you the bag. And he chooses to die, like genuinely. And this guy's like, he calls another guy over and he's like, okay, well, like, can we like transfer his job to someone else? And the guy's like, we don't even need to. If you give me a telephone, I'll talk to the Swiss. And like, man, automation comes for us all if you're, but like his job can be replaced by a telephone. It's like brutal. And then he says, well, you're going to tell us where the bag is because, you know, we're more intelligent than you. And because you're a good man. And
we're the fucking mafia.
Yeah. I mean, I think the joke of this line is that it's kind of like wrong on both counts almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's like, no, I won't. And he's like, okay, fine. Well, put him in a car with some more large men. Where are we going for dinner this evening? Like, they're not bothered. Mm-hmm. Like, not even angry at all.
I guess if you have 220 billion, like 9 million is a fucking rounding error.
And also, to be fair, like, the mafia kind of understand if a dude's in a sort of, like, I had to do it situation. They can just write that off on the taxes. It's their bread and butter. They're like, yeah, they had to do it.
Uomo di onore. Yeah, absolutely. So they get him in the car. The guy who he called Pippo is, like, seemingly asleep. He's, like, left his gun out. And for a second, you can see he's thinking about, like, going for it. Like, doing some Jason Bourne shit.
Applying for the Kronstein rosette.
Yeah. And this is where he's flashing back. And this is where we see him back in the room. The guys take the briefcase. He calls the guy and he's like, oh, I'll be there in 2 days. And then he activates a mode I like to call,
I'm in the process of dealing with these Guido motherfuckers.
Because
he goes sicko mode, to be fair to him, he does.
Yeah, he does.
He shuts down the lift so they have to take the stairs, reactivates the power so he can take the lift, gets down and ahead of them, waits in the car, which he like has covered over, and then as soon as they try and get in the car, he just shoots both of them, takes the bag, puts their bodies in the trunk. Ice cold. Also, like, not particularly like John Wick, you know, not particularly Jason Bourne, which I like, you know, he's panicked, he's nervous, he doesn't do any, like, fancy shit.
He just kind of gets the drop on these two guys.
Yeah.
So
it's not difficult to shoot two people when they're not expecting it, you know, and that's what he does.
I've always found this.
Yeah. And so...
putting this on my mafia job application form.
He doesn't say any of this, he just sort of, like, remembers it, and then he's back in the car. And the guy up front, big guy, is, like, explaining to him exactly all the ways in which he's fucked up. And he's like... listen, fucking, the guy you called on the phone, people, he wanted to be, like, independent. That's why he presumably, like, sent his cousins to steal this money. Now he's independent. He looks back, the guy's fucking dead. They've, like, killed him in the course of doing this silently. And then he's like, but the big guy, the boss, like, he likes you, you know that? He didn't care when you stole that $100,000, you know, he just wrote that off as you paying yourself. And you can see that this is a shock because he knew about this, but of course he did. He's like, you know, you could fucking get out of this. You could have a new life. He might be lying about that. We don't know. But he's like, yeah, he likes you. All you have to do is tell him where the money is. And the reason why he can't tell him where the money is both because he has decided on this sort of like cause of death, but also because he has given it to the fucking old couple.
He has indeed. He's deposited 9 million off in the hotel room of old couple.
Mm-hmm. Getting them back to sort of...
how do we feel about this, boys? How do we feel about taking pity on the old petty bourgeois?
Could have given it to your brother.
Could have given it to any other character, any of the women. I don't know, man. Yeah, maybe you had a new lease of life.
Could have given it to charity.
See, you fucked up here. It's a couple of petty bourgeois swine, and now you're going to be killed by the mafia.
Yeah, it's a stage play. You know, you have to go with the characters you have. Yeah, but yeah, and so it's really brutal just hearing exactly how badly he has fucked up the sort of internal politics of the mafia here. That he's just been sort of like he has signed his own death warrant and continues to like actively chooses to for basically no reason other than the fact that he thinks that no one can love him.
Yeah, he's like, it's time to die, I'm just going to go out weird mode.
They still don't even try and kill him. They try and torture him to like get him to tell them where the bag is by suspending him from a crane over a big pool of like wet concrete in a quary. And the guy's literally trying to do him a favor. He's like, as soon as you start talking, we like cut off the crane, just stops. And you know, he's terrified, but he doesn't say a word. Just like plunges straight down. And as he does, you get as his head goes beneath the level of the concrete, and you see a couple of like air bubbles escape. You cut to Dino Giuffre, his best friend in the Alps, fucking like feeling like the stirring of something, thinking about him, and it's just like absolute sort of loneliness, and the kind of the connection that you can only get from absolute loneliness, as he sort of like horribly martyrs himself because of the fucking consequences of love.
Try walking away in concrete shoes, motherfucker.
It's concrete sort of like balaclava and sort of like trench coat at this point also.
Mm. Problem is that concrete was aerated and he's currently wearing his way out of a British school.
Some child is going to be traumatized when his body just falls through the ceiling of double English.
This is a very serious Italian man.
It's like a foot coming through PE.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm conscious I've kind of just been like relating the plot of this movie a little bit, but like, I don't know. I think it's important to get all the details down, and now I want to like open it up a bit for like however long of discussion it takes to be like, what do we fucking make of this? Like,
it made me very glad I'm not a man. It seems like it's not good.
Mm.
It certainly is a movie about the male concept of, like, you know, being that sort of stoic individual. And when he's talking about like that being the only way to be like a man, although he seems to be disabused of this notion.
It is possible to love, but sometimes like in so doing, particularly if you've like closed yourself off from it for so long, you just kind of doom yourself and everyone around you, is I guess the thesis to me.
I am consciously trying in the last few months to be more vulnerable and to open myself up to the consequences of love a little bit, so I guess I'm a little bit worried I'm gonna end up in concrete. Now that's a fear I didn't have before, but I liked it. I thought it was good. I think it's like, you know, it's nice to have some capital C cinema with like themes and aesthetics and shit like that. I recommend it. It's good.
I mean, it's darker than a lot of sort of like Paolo Sorrentino movies. I want us to watch The Hand of God at some point, because I had a really good time with that, and also because I admire beautiful Italian women. But yeah, I think the sort of vision of masculinity presented in this, I think it contends with a kind of masculinity that is quite incel, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that by circumstances beyond your control, you have been forced to isolate yourself from everyone around you, and you know, whether you sort of like you hate it or whether you're stoic about it, this is no way to live. It is like functionally it's a living death.
Well, right? He's kind of volcel though, because this is a prison he's built for himself.
That's true.
I mean, I guess that's also the case with incels, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah, it's sort of like in this case he's kind of choosing literal death over figurative death. And I think that's portrayed as something like entirely natural and even preferable, because, you know, as Carlo says, you know, you die extraordinarily, right? And there is absolutely nothing extraordinary about his life as he has lived it up until the point where he's like begins to fall in love.
Man, I don't know, dude. I got a lot of thoughts, but I haven't like sifted through them. I feel like this is going to be one of those movies I want to think about for longer than I let myself think about it. I tried to treat this like one of those last minute ones where I can watch the movie and then do the thing, but I needed some digestion.
No, I mean, genuinely though, like I am always really happy when I pick a movie that like gets any of us like this. It makes me feel like I've, you know, like just like achieved an
cultural victory
here, you know?
Yeah, it's nice to have some like actual like capital C cinema on the podcast. I would be interested in seeing more by this director.
Hmm. But yeah, yeah, I hope so. And I think in particular, it's nice for me to see Italian cinema that sort of is entirely in a sort of northern icy, I mean, most of it's in Switzerland, but like even so, that kind of biome, you know, because a lot of it has kind of like, even from the same director, has been like very keen, and I think often to great effect, to play into kind of like southern latitudes and like Mediterranean and like warm climes and like warm colors and stuff. Whereas this is like, you know, concerned with the northern bourgeois part of Italy that is like, you know, basically just weird talking Austrians where, of course, your wife doesn't speak to you. And it's sort of like view of this is no, this is like living death, which is very funny to me.
It's quite British. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like spiritually English.
I think you could do a like very promising British remake of this.
But. I think it's really interesting as well that like all of these characters, the biggest thing that's ever happened to them is in the past. This is very much a movie about people who've like other movies would have finished by now if it was about their life.
Yes.
Right? Like it's people who have done everything that was interesting in their like 20s and 30s and 40s and are now just having to live out like the last couple of decades of a life just in the shadow of kind of themselves in a little way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite a sort of negative view of aging, but then again, it's sort of like it's because you age into the sort of the habits that you develop in your youth, it seems, or you know, in response to the sort of the events of your youth, and that's what's created, you know, like Carlo's gambling problem, or well, for that matter, Tita's gambling problem. Sort of like locking them in this fucking hotel is yeah. I mean, it's brutal, but I didn't think it was like a sort of a heartbreakingly sad movie exactly, but I think it's sort of like it's only a downer, and I'm excited therefore to record the next episode that we're doing, the next mainline one, which is some goofy bullshit about spies.
I think the important thing is to have the two lines be like tonally
when we go serious on bonus, we got to do dumbass on the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us for the serious bit of the podcast. We hope you'll continue to join us on the dumbass bit of the podcast. And thank you for subscribing to the Patreon as well. And we will see you next time.
Yeah.
Ciao.
Criminal tax evasion.
Bellissimo podcasterino, gentlemen. Thank you for listening to yet another episode of Kill James Blunt. Next week on the free feed, it's the return of OSS on the set. It is Shadow of Evil, also known as Panic in Bangkok, also known as one of four or five other things. But it's the one with Cohen Matthews made in 1964. And you can watch it. And actually, I'd even recommend that one because we had a great time watching it, a great time talking about it. And the episode that comes out next week is one that I'm very happy with. So it also includes the return of a couple of awards from season one. If you're hearing this, you are a patron, so thank you for your support. A special thanks to our £15 and above patrons, and those are Lobjornsdottir, Candy Fox, Freya Aloysius, Gustavo Lira, Jack Holmes, Mike Berg, Hannah Oberhart, Nick Boris, Power Dad, Jason Hager, George Rohack, let me know if that was the wrong pronunciation, by the way, Jason. Kentucky Fried Commie, Yarek, Drone Lover, Cohen Enright, Nata Mori, Alaya, Labor Delenda S, Library Hitman, Beef Crime, Jack Drummond, Callum Burney, Max Gamenhart, Jonathan Gerd, Kit Divine Hell, J. Martin Del Top, O Mothman, Trip, Emery, or maybe Emrys, can't decide yet, A Trans Robot, Trucker Blondie, Maeve Victoria Roth, Rosie, Can't Fail, Touchable Tips, Joyous Uwu, Zan Hutch, and David Alexander B. Steve Widdershins, Just the Worst. I think I've done that one about David before. I'm sorry, mate. You must get that all the fucking time. Stephen Calvert, Isopod Gal, Bronan, Clarification, Alex, Violet, Cyber, Liz, and Ash, and Florida, Annie, Ruby, Nobles, Oblahaj, John, 2089, Corvid, Cultist, Wolfscott, Connors, Cool Big Sister, Virat, Sukat, Saint Chen, Ramona, Random, Katie, Brubst, Emily, Queen of Sloths, Zoe Shepherd, Electro, Cyber Puppy, Abigail, Quinn Valeri, Los Pycock, Alfredo, Mortran, Al Owing, Tercy, Shindai Alone, Hey Alfredo, 5DKK per month. I don't even know what that means, but that better be enough, motherfucker. Wolfie, Philippa Smith, Finn Ross, Millie, Josh Simmons, Robert Greensmith, Lauren Bassin, Mega Combi, and Grendel Growls. Thank you. Your support. Killjin's Wand is Alice, Abigail, and Devon. Our producer is the wonderful Nate Bethay. Our podcast art is by Maddie Lubchansky, and our website is by Tom Allen. See ya.